Aloha and welcome to Auntie K Gone Global. That's right, we're going to go global family live. Now, no matter where you are or what your life feels like right now, this hour is for you. So just relax and take a deep breath. Allow yourself to breathe in your aliveness. And breathe out and release your stress of the day. Breathe in the love. And gently release your breath in gratitude. Always in gratitude for the breath. Well, what's happening? Why are we changing the name of the show to Global Family Live? I've been watching the changes in life in the last 3 weeks, and we've been talking about it on the show. More than ever, it's evident that global family consciousness is the format, it's the way that we will create a new world, a safe world for our children, for our future. So Aloha Auntie K will be still living with the Aloha Spirit and focusing even more on all of the ways that we can look at our life and explore what's happening and bring more light and bring more breath into our daily living, each one of us and together. So let's talk a little bit about the emotional temperature for this last week. Now, we've been noticing, and I've been reporting to you, that internationally, this last 3 weeks has been an escalating energetic pattern. This last week particularly seemed to reach an exaggerated state of dramatic changes for many, many people. Changes that just seemed to come right out of left field, and these are really big changes. Lifestyle big changes. Some were moves. Some were changes in employment, some were natural disasters, fire coming after their homes. So the main reason I want to have a little report each week on the emotional temperature of what's happening in the world, I found over the years we feel a lot better if we realize we're not alone. When these times of dramatic change occur, we really do like to know that we're interconnected with others. So we truly are. And I want to remind you that you can call in tonight. We have a wonderful, wonderful guest. We're going to be talking about what is this thing called money? And Daryl Shun is my guest. So you can call in the U.S. 877-876-5227, Canada, 888-815-0756, and anywhere else in the world, a direct line to BBS Internet Radio, 530-876-3222. Thank you so much, and if you're just tuning in, this is Auntie K Gone Global, now becoming the Global Family Live. So, Daryl, are you online with me here?
I am here, Kay.
Welcome, Daryl. How are things down there in Tucson? I understand you've been getting a lot of rain.
A lot of rain, unexpected, but I think that is sort of an indication of where our planet is at right now.
Yes, our beloved mother is definitely going through some transformations. Therefore, so are we on so many levels. And I want to tell our audience just a little bit about some of your background here, Daryl, before you and I start a very fun conversation. Now, one thing I'd like our audience to know is you might be of Chinese heritage, but from my awareness, you really live on this planet as an international citizen. And with your extensive life experiences, your travels, your global social interaction, I really see how this has prepared you to share your expertise regarding the world currency and how this is influencing our evolving global family. Now, I've read both of your books, and I know these are internationally known books. You have How to Survive the Crisis and Prosper in the Process, which is available at www.survivethecrisis.com. And then your lovely, lovely book, Daryl, Light in a Dark Place, which was published in May of 2006 by Bolinas Press. Now, I know that you have such a compelling interest in the economic conditions in the world that seem to be indicating a collapse that you are foreseeing for this country of America and how this will affect the world. And I know that you said after studying this situation for so many years that you've concluded that this collapse will give our planet a unique chance to reorder on a higher level, which I know is so important to you because you really function and focus and are dedicated that together we are better. Now, I'm fascinated, Daryl. How and when did you start becoming interested in economy, economics, currency, and then into the world field as well? Could you fill us in on that a little bit?
It was unexpected. I've been in business all my life in various areas, but I never expected to have to study the economy as I have in the past 10 years. What happened is that in the 1990s, I became interested in the phenomena of the Great Depression. It was a question that occurred to me. It wasn't driven by anything except curiosity. And what I knew of the Depression, it was that it was unique, that it occurred one time. It had just brought the world economy to a halt. And it had started, you know, people say the date started in 1929 with the stock market crash, but it basically lasted until through the World War II. And the economy finally started moving again. And you know, we're used to expansions and contractions. We're used to things speeding up. We're used to things slowing down. We're used to periods of prosperity followed by periods of where things get a little tough. But the Depression was not like anything like this. The Depression, you know, my metaphor about the Depression, Kay, it was like, it's like your toilet. Your toilet generally functions. The water goes out, the water comes back in. And when it does get in trouble, sometimes you just got to jiggle the handle. Sometimes you have to put water in it and bring it back up, and it'll go again. And when it gets real bad, you call in the plumber.
Mm-hmm.
But the Great Depression was a time at which, economically, they called in the plumber. They jiggled it. They put water in it. They did all the things they'd done before. And they called in the plumber. And the plumber came, and he looked at it, and he tried it. He worked on it. And you said, do anything finally that you can. Just try and make it work again. And as hard as he tried, the plumber couldn't make it work again. Well, it was the curiosity of what was it. And so when I started reading, I found out that economics, like religion, like metaphysics, there's a whole lot of opinion. A tremendous amount of opinion. Not a lot of critical thinking and not a lot of truth. And if there is truth in the opinion, people don't know it. They may hold the truth, but they hold it as an opinion. They really don't understand what it really is. And I was very, very fortunate in my reading and in my experience that I was sort of led to certain things and began to see things in a certain way. And that happened around 10 years ago. I started around 10 years ago. And what happened is that out of the blue, the dot-com bubble erupted and collapsed. it was virtually a replica of the 1929 speculative bubble, stock market bubble that collapsed that set off the Great Depression. And when this happened, I had enough reading under my belt, and that it wasn't something that was happened like without reference. I had developed a frame of reference, a historical frame of reference, and some critical thinking. So when I saw it happening, things made sense to me that would not have made sense to me before. And my feeling is that we are headed, we averted the depression in 2002 through Greenspan's liquefying the economy with a huge amount of money. I mean, that's when money was given away by the banks. I mean, people know that between 2002-2005, virtually anybody could walk into a bank, get a loan for up to $500,000, even more, without providing any income verification, and buy a house, no money down. These are from people who would look at you and look at your loan application 5 years before and look at you with tremendous suspicion, and you would feel it. Now, all of a sudden, these same people were handing money over to you, to anybody, without asking any questions at all. Now, most people were so happy about getting the money, they didn't ask why. There was a reason. And the reason was, they turned on the floodgates of money because they were afraid that we were perhaps headed for another Great Depression. And that's why it happened. And there were consequences for them doing so, and the consequences now. And people have no idea what those consequences are and the situation they're in. My metaphor about it, Kay, is like being in New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I'd been studying levees and weather patterns. Like you asked me, how did I become interested in economics? In that metaphor, I could say, well, you know, my dad was an engineer and, you know, and I had some, you know, I'd gone to engineering school and I had, you know, I was became very interested in the levee system in New Orleans. So I started looking at the levees, when they were built, who built them, the stress they could take. And over a period of years, I had a decent foundation of knowledge about the levee system in New Orleans and the stresses that they were subject to and their vulnerabilities. Now, what most people don't know is, in 2005, when the levees did go down, the U.S. government had already determined that a levee collapse in New Orleans was one of the three greatest dangers to the United States. The other was being an earthquake in San Francisco, and the other one being a terrorist attack. But the government didn't tell anybody this. And even as the hurricanes came and were level 5, they still said nothing. And they had, you know, quote, departments that were supposed to be in charge of preparedness, FEMA, all these things like that, and they did nothing. This situation developing with the economy is even worse. Not only does the U.S. government know more than they knew about Hurricane Katrina, they're more concerned. The truth of the matter is, the people in charge of government really didn't have a vested interest in New Orleans. It was just, they had their own agendas, and New Orleans was real low down on their priority list. So when it did happen, they were unprepared, as they are for most things. Now, this is a very interesting question, because the truth of the matter is, they are prepared for this one, but not in the way you would like to think they are. Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United States, Kiplinger Magazine last year in their May issue reported that up to 25% of Dick Cheney's money, which is anywhere that constitutes anywhere from $15 to $25 million, was invested in the American International, Century Bond Fund. And the bond fund profits when the dollar drops. So here you have the vice president of the country plugged in at the highest levels to what the country knows, one of the captains of industry, because this country is basically run by corporations and Wall Street, and he's betting against the U.S. dollar.
Now, if we had this going on in a corporation, Darryl, we would call this a conflict of interest, wouldn't we?
Yes, but you see, Americans are asleep. And I think being asleep is due to two things, Kay. One, they've been willfully led astray by the media, by the government, by the people in power. and they wanted to be asleep. I believe that most Americans don't want to know what's happening. And they've been, and if they do want to know, they don't even know that they want to know. And now that the great unraveling is beginning, it's going to be a question of who wakes up. Now, we went back, you started this thing about the thought about a shift to a higher level, and I absolutely believe that's going to happen. I mean, I believe that this is a natural process of nature, of the mother, of the father, together. And there's an extraordinary book called The Great Wave. It was written by a professor called, his name is David Hackett Fisher. And he deals with economic history. And in our economic history, we've had these periods he calls great waves. And great waves happen every 100, 200 years. And they will erupt during a period of prosperity very slowly. And as the wave develops, it intensifies. And crises happen. Prices start going up. The difference between the rich and the poor increase. All sorts of things happen. And at the end of each great wave, they always end in an economic collapse. And these are very, very fractious. They are uncomfortable. They rent the fabric of society apart. But Fisher pointed out that what happens at the end of every great wave is that the society reorders itself on a higher, better level. There was a great wave, for example, between the feudal ages of the 12th, 13th centuries and the Renaissance of the 15th century. There was a great wave between the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, a great wave between the Enlightenment and the Victorian era of stability. And at the end of the Victorian era of stability, in 1896, Dr. Fisher said, another great wave began. We are at the tail end of that great wave. We are in the final stages of that wave. A wave that will end, as the other waves always have, in an economic collapse, in a collapse of the present order, a rearranging itself into a newer, better, higher order. Hopefully, history will repeat itself. And one can never tell how it is going to, the form of it. We can only, I liken it, Kay, to a snake shedding its skin, the process of metamorphosis. The moth has no idea it's going to turn into a butterfly. It only knows it's in crisis when it enters that period. It only knows great changes upon it. We have no idea what the moth's consciousness is. We can suspect that if it's anything like the human consciousness, it becomes terrified. Because intense change is not its forte. Stability is. The tried and true is. What we know is. And as many of people really don't like or uncomfortable with present power structures, present economic structures, the present direction of the economy, the present direction of political systems, the present wars on this planet, most people would rather have that and be faced with the unknown, because that's where the fear is. Because there is very little belief that it's going to end better. But that's what my belief is, that it is going to raise us up. It's a natural process, and it is, as all the other ways before it, not easy. I mean, in Professor Fisher's book, The Great Wave, the first way that he examines is the transition from the feudal era into the Renaissance. Now, we all know about the Renaissance, you know, the Medici family and Michelangelo and the arts and the flowering of writing, and it was like a great burst of fresh air, especially after the feudal ages.
Well, and I think, you know, Daryl, what I love with what you're sharing with us is the world currency is something that human beings have made up. It doesn't come from nature. It comes from a human idea and a human choice. And yet what I'm hearing you're reporting to us, and according to what the great waves that Fisher is talking about, that in spite of this being a human creation, it still gets called into the natural pattern of regeneration, because if anybody has lived anywhere where there's four seasons,
yes,
that there's always the spring with the new life, then there's the summer where that life is expanded, then there's the fall where it goes into fruition and transformation in preparation for the winter. And if we look at the tree as it's losing its leaves, it looks like it's dying.
Yes.
When in fact, what it's doing is taking the power into the roots to strengthen and grow a new life and come forth in the spring. So it's very fascinating to me with what you've just shared, that this human idea and this made-up game called money still is requested to live and participate with the universal laws on this planet.
That's a very good point, Kay. As unnatural as money is, and I'd like to go into that next, because money is not natural, not the way it is now. But as unnatural as our present construct of money is, the point you made is absolutely true, that it is subsumed into the greater cycle of nature and of life itself.
Mm-hmm.
That nothing that man does is outside of that cycle.
Exactly. And we are about to personally, daily, individually, and collectively truly come to another level of respect and honor for what nature really is, which I recognized so much when I was in Kauai and participated in Hurricane Iniki, which was September 11th of 1992.
Yeah.
And with that force of wind, the breath, and that Iniki name is the sharp, piercing breath, for 5 hours of 167 mile an hour to 227 mile an hour, that the incredible experience of what happens when nature takes over and the balance that it immediately brought within 5 hours. There was no one on the island who could use any money, no matter how much they had. It didn't make any difference. It was the greatest equalizer of anything I've ever experienced in a matter of 5 hours from nature. So I think our correlation here is to do exactly what you're saying, Daryl. There is nothing that can be created that isn't part of the universal divine order, in spite of our arrogance as humans, to think that we're separate and dominant over all other forms of life. So I have a huge trust in the universe orchestrating and managing these changes, even with this distorted money game that we humans have created.
You know, Kay, it's one of the metaphors I have about humanity in the context of who we really are is that we're teenagers in the house of God. And the universe has allowed us to be that. And as such, we, not knowing who we are, or where we've come from, or what we are in, have really, really pushed the boundaries. And the earth it reflects that. Our money system reflects that. We have a country here in the United States which is allegedly the wealthiest country in the world, but it isn't anymore. It once was, not so long ago. The United States was the wealthiest country in the world. It had more gold than any country in the history of the world had ever owned. In 1949, the United States had 75% of the world's monetary gold. 1949. No country had ever owned that much gold. In 20 short years, that gold was virtually gone. What gold was left, we kept and reneged on our promise to pay. And Americans don't know this. But I think, whether they know it or not, it's going to be like Hurricane Katrina, especially when the dollar continues to collapse, when it goes down. The chickens are coming home to roost. It doesn't matter whether or not you know about an STD.
Right.
If you get one.
Right.
It doesn't matter if you understand money when all of a sudden your economy collapses.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you tried to deny your way through life and said, I can't deal, I don't want to know about it. You know, everything's all right. I'm taken care of. It doesn't matter. Because when it hits, when reality finally interjects itself in your reality, economically, spiritually, emotionally, there's nothing you can do to resist it. And I think in a way, our economy reflects how we've handled ourselves emotionally and spiritually on this planet. And we've basically gone off on our own. I mean, we basically constructed an economic Tower of Babel.
Uh-huh.
You know, what people don't understand what money is. I mean, we use it every day. It's like fish don't understand water.
Right.
All right? I mean, it's just there. All right? They breathe, they use it, and it's always been there. But what fish don't understand is that all of a sudden the water is having, like, heavy metal in it, PCBs. You know, they're still breathing, they're still going around, they're still migrating, you know, they're still doing what they're doing. But the nature of their very environment is changing. And what people don't understand is that a tremendous shift happened in money around 200 years ago. This thing that we call capitalism, this thing that, you know, you hear about, you know, that, you know, it's like, go capitalism, like, go Tigers, go 49ers, you know, down, Marxist, you know, don't, anti-capitalist, you know. People don't understand what it is. But just to, I mean, before, I call it modern banking, all right? And modern banking happened in the world approximately around 1800s. And before the 1800s, before modern banking, money was a medium of exchange. If I grew something, if I had cows, if I had grain, if I was a cobbler, or I did something, and you had need of my goods or services, money was what you gave me in return for my goods or services. And it was neutral. It wasn't something in itself that I would use. For example, a straight barter would be that if I had grain and you were a fisherman or fisherwoman, or you sewed or did something like that, and I traded you something I had for something you had, and then maybe I gave you something you could eat, and I got from you something I could wear. That was straight barter, use for use. Money was something neutral. Money was something that, of value, I could give you. You could hold on to it and give it to somebody else for something they had.
So a real means of exchange.
It was a means of exchange. It facilitated exchange. Now, over the years, I mean, it was sort of human nature. I would not give you something, nor would you give me anything, unless what I gave you, you trusted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I gave you a little piece of paper with an X marked on it, you'd look at me and go, what am I going to do with this? You know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right, but if it was a piece of paper with an X on it that everybody accepted, you would just do it and go on with it and do it. But that wasn't how it was. For millennia, in the East and in the West, money was essentially gold or silver. Coin. It was coin. All right? I mean, in this way, whether you were a farmer in wherever, it didn't matter. It was trusted. And the thing about it, and I want to point out here, is that even then, when money was either gold or silver, the governments would attempt to debase it. They would, you know, issue a gold coin. And around 200 years later, they'd be cutting it with copper or brass or something like that, or making it smaller. They always wanted more out of that coin.
Mm-hmm.
All right? That was just human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Governments wanted more. And basically, they wanted more to clobber the government next to them,
mm-hmm.
or to live better
mm-hmm.
at everybody else's expense.
Coming from the whole principle of lack and scarcity.
Coming from the principle of lack and scarcity to being on top of the pile.
Right.
That's really what it was. Once human beings got to the top of the pile, the next thought was, how do I leverage this, my being on top? All right? And so for centuries in the West and in the East, money was either gold or silver, and it was coins. And something funny happened around the 18th century. Let's go back to
the thought just one moment.
Okay.
I want to just remind our listeners, if you've just joined us, my special guest that's speaking here is Daryl Shun, who has done years of extensive research on this thing we call money. So that's what we're doing tonight here on Anti-K Gone Global to Global Family Live, we're talking about what is this thing called money. So I'm happy you've joined us. If you couldn't join us at the beginning, and go ahead, Daryl, finish and share some more information with us.
Okay. Let's go back. Previous to the 1800s, when modern banking first emerged, when you had your traditional forms of money, gold or coin, what would happen is that a thing called interest developed, where people who had managed to accumulate more gold or an excess amount of gold or silver, and other people had need of it, they would oftentimes loan this out or give it to somebody and say, well, I'm going to give you this, but you got to promise to pay it back. And if you promise to pay it back, I want more or whatever it is that than I gave you. All right? And this was called usury. All right? That was the real name for it, usury. All right, it was basically interest. Usury began to be known as outrageous amounts of interest, but basically usury was just another name for interest, people charging more money for the use of their money over their period of time. Now, what is very, very interesting about this is that this is where the religions all agreed. The Jewish religion, the Christian religion, and the Muslims. All three major religions in the West agreed that usury was wrong. The Jewish religion, it was very interesting. They said, well, it's sort of wrong, but maybe under certain circumstances you can charge it to Gentiles, but certainly not among us. And Muslims and Christians shared the same basic attitude about the charging of interest for the use of money. All right? And now, I think a very interesting question should be asked. How did this phenomena, this charging of interest, go from a shunned, ecclesiastically condemned phenomena to the very foundation of the modern economic world? What people don't realize is that the Fed fund overnight rate, the interest rate that people are watching with so much, that when you go down and you buy a house, everything has to do with your interest rate. Your bank has to do with the interest rate. Your, you know, everything has interest attached to it.
Exactly.
It's the very foundation of money. Your credit card is nothing more than a interest-bearing relationship. Interest or usury used to be, as recently as, 200 years ago? A basically, let's call it economic adultery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Let's call usury economic adultery. And in the period of 200 years, everyone's screwing around.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, everyone's doing it. Now, how did this come to pass? Well, it's sort of interesting, and it sort of makes sense once you realize how it happened. England was the birthplace of the switch. And this island, which is, that's what it was, previous to the 18th century, 19th century, it was a, you know, a little country like, all these countries were little countries, kingdoms, fiefdoms, fiefdoms, right? Dukedoms, princes, kings, queens, right? Courts. And like every other court around the world generally, they had designs on the courts around them, all right? Ambition. Territorial ambition, money. Let's you know, the guys at the top of the pile, once they climbed to the top of the pile, they looked at the piles around and wanted that pile too. That's human nature, or it has been. And so what happened was this. They decided, well, not that they decided, they found out that they could do a switch of their money system. And by switching their money system from what I called a productivity and savings-based system, where people produced and saved, they could go to a debt-based system, a system that the bankers understood in the West, all right? The private banking houses. They were the ones who charged interest. And basically, they went to England, or England went to them. I think England went to them first, but I think, you know, they certainly weren't, you know, weren't turning away at the door. And the deal was cut, the deal with that the devil made, all right, and that we're all paying for right now. And the deal was this. To the government, the private banker said, listen to this. king, you let us issue the money in this land of yours, all right? And we'll give you the keys to empire and conquest. And the king goes, how so? And the banker said this, well, let's say you've been looking at France, Germany, the colonies, the rest of the world, and you've been wanting to extend your power over these places because you want to take their wealth for yours. You want to take their land and make it your land. But to do so, you need to raise an army. And to raise an army and to raise a navy takes money. And money is savings. How much savings do you have? I mean, already you're living off the fat of the land. Already you're, you know, taking your people's, you know, grain and harvest and taking it up and, you know, powdering your wigs and having court balls and, you know, and living off the fat of the land while all these other people are working. You know, that takes a slice right there. But if you really want to go after the rest of the world, if you really want to set your sights on France, Germany, great kingdoms, a lot of money, a lot of land, a lot of wealth, then you're going to need a lot of money to raise the requisite armies and the requisite navies. And with our system, you'll be able to do so. Now, this caught the interest of government. Government, which has always wanted empire, conquest over others. All of a sudden, the keys to the kingdom got hung in front of the governments, kings, their ministers, and all they had to do was allow private bankers to issue debt money. Now, what people don't know is that the money that they're walking around with, or what they call money, is very different than the money when this country was founded. This country, the United States of America, was founded, and it was like all other countries were at that time, basically founded on savings and productivity. Only England had made that shift, was making that shift at the time. Thomas Jefferson warned this country that if we ever went the way of England, its people would be in economic servitude, paying off forever the taxes imposed on it. And he was right. But what England did was, they took the bait. And since they were the first one out of the gate, and since England had the Industrial Revolution happening on their soil first, they were able to combine the Industrial Revolution with the revolution of modern banking, arm their navy and armies, and basically conquer the rest of the world. And as so doing, impose their system of money on the rest of the world, and the rest of the world became indebted to the English, economically and physically. Now, most people don't understand this, but that doesn't matter. Most fish don't know that the nature of the water that they're breathing now is changing. But when the levels of PCBs or mercury gets high enough, they are going to know. They're going to die out. And what Americans, whether they know it or not, the system that they're living in, or people around the rest of the world know it or not, the economic waters in which they're living in are piling up. I don't know if they notice it, but like New Orleans, the floodwaters are rising. And the evidence of that is the amount of debt that they owe, that the amount the parents owe. All of a sudden, when their parents are in health crises, they are using their credit cards to go to the doctor. They didn't do this before. All of a sudden, when the kids want to go to school, they'd be able to get a summer job before work, you know, do this. Now, they get loans, $15,000, $20,000 a year, free credit cards. And the kids are coming out owing more money than they're ever going to be able to pay off.
So we have a reflection going on here, don't we, with Mother Nature in its natural evolution, that global warming is part of the natural evolution of this planet. And one of the events of that is the water is rising. So when you're speaking about our economic condition, that the water is rising economically as well as the literal water on this planet is rising, and it seems to be pretty synchronous.
The crises are happening. They are synchronous, okay? We are living, you know, I don't know if this is true or not, but it's said that there's a Chinese saying, may you, a curse, May you be born in interesting times. Well, these are not just interesting times. These are most interesting times. I had an inkling that we were headed towards something like this years ago, and I didn't want to deal with it. It was just, if we were going to shift to another reality, if this Aquarian age or whatever was going to do, blah, 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 you know, if the earth changes of Edgar Cayce are going to come true, if it just seemed to be all doom and destruction and, you know, not much wanting to be around during that time.
And see, the thing I loved so much about Edgar Cayce's predictions, which, you know, those started in the 1930s because he died in 1945, that the main thing that he told the world at that time with his predictions about the Ring of Fire and the changes with the Earth, that this did not have to occur if the consciousness of the people changed. Now, do you feel that same condition applies to this man-made thing called world currency, that if our consciousness changed, would that influence the collapse that you see is inevitable?
I don't think so. I think the process has gone too far. I may be wrong here, Kay. I may be wrong. Predicting the economy is like predicting the weather.
Exactly.
I mean, we always seem to have a winter and a spring and a summer and a fall, but the exact nature of that, within the context of that, a lot happens. And the same thing with the economy. Now, in terms of being able to avert where we are, we would like it to be so. It's sort of like a question of asking a person, a man who's drunk a bottle of whiskey all his life, all right, and once was just in prime shape, and now he's 42, he's got a cirrhosis of the liver, he's got a heart condition. I mean, he's basically on his way out, and the thought comes, well, if I change, am I going to escape this? Well, I think in a very great degree, if he changed enough, yes. So there is an answer to your question, yes. I do believe that perhaps if the collective consciousness of humanity did change to a certain amount, a great degree, what appears to be in process would be mitigated. And I think the reason why I said no is because I don't believe, from my observations of humanity, that it is going to shift, that it is going to be aware enough to sidestep what is happening to us and to be able to take preemptive action.
Well, you know, if we look at the flow or lack of flow in money in the same eyes that we would look at our bloodstream in our body, if our bloodstream in our body, each person's body, was as blocked and stagnant as the money situation has become in the world, everyone would be dead.
Yes.
Because there is no circulation. And on this planet, the breath, the life force, the universal laws, there's a law of movement. There's a law of circulation.
Yes.
So if consciousness were to influence this artificial creation called world currency, it would then, it appears to me, it would have to be involved with circulation, that this distribution, distortion that's going on and creating the appearance of lack, when in fact there is none and there's no reason for this, that we would have to literally, consciousness would have to open up and be truly functioning on this planet as a global family.
Okay, I believe you're right, and I believe it is going to happen, but I believe it's going to be forced.
One way or the other.
I believe humanity is so intransigent,
mm-hmm.
so set in its ways, and the powers of this present civilization are so powerful,
mm-hmm.
and their inertial pattern so set that it's going to take a cataclysmic change to change things, and I believe that it's going to change. Your viewers and the listeners here, I mean, my book it basically deals with the current crises. All right, there's another book they may be interested in. Fascinating book called The Future of Money by Bert. And you know this man, you know Jacqueline Dunn. We talked about him, Bernard.
Mm-hmm.
How do you pronounce the last name, Kay? Leitier?
Leitier,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
He wrote a book called The Future of Money. And it's an extraordinary book. Bernard was the, he was in 1989, Business Week named him the top currency trader in the world.
Dale, I want to take just a moment here. I heard a bleep, and I want to check to make sure if we have a caller calling in here just a moment. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
Maui, Hawaii.
Oh, good. Do you have a question that you'd like to ask?
Well, I was wondering if Daryl could touch on what his suggestions would be for individuals as far as how to, what they could do to protect themselves the most from this upcoming major crisis coming.
So to provide some guidelines maybe that would be helpful for individuals and conscious people to support this life during this change?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a wonderful idea. Daryl, could you support us with some information on that?
Yes.
And thank you for calling in.
My belief is that we are, however you want to put it, or however you want to see it, the crisis that's developing, for example, the subprime, happy now, a collapse of the credit markets, a drying of liquidity. 6 months, 5 months ago, it looked like the liquidity, you know, the river was never going to end. It would never been higher, never been float faster. And now all of a sudden, you know, hedge funds are going down, and we're entering a totally different period. However it happens, my belief is that at its base, at its essence, it's going to be a monetary crisis. It may be triggered by a hedge fund collapse. It may be triggered by a credit problem. It may be triggered by this. But basically, it's a monetary problem. Because when the modern era of modern banking began, it substituted paper and debt for real value. That's what we don't understand. That's what I didn't understand when I started my study of this. I didn't understand the nature of money, and I understood very little about it. And I've been a businessman all my life. I mean, the last time the Fed slammed the interest rates up to hold inflation down in 1972, I had a $400,000 line of credit.
Well, and, you know, Daryl, the thing that this, based on what our callers request is, and also realizing that you've had 10 years of extensive research in this field, and myself and our listeners can recognize you're very, very knowledgeable in what brought this condition to the forefront here. But we're dealing with a nation that is not knowledgeable, a nation that not only doesn't even know this is happening, and even if they did know it was happening, they still wouldn't have a clue what to do. So that's the place. Do you have some ideas how to translate this knowledge you have into some usable guidelines for helping this move through the nation and people begin to be aware and be more accountable? What are your suggestions for that?
Regarding the question of the caller from Kauai, of what can be done, it's in a way it's rather simplistic. Being a monetary crisis, the thing that's going to be a haven in this time is things of value. Because money became a piece of paper, an IOU, backed by nothing except the promise to pay and demand that you take it, and has just created so much huge amounts of debt, that when the edifice falls, it's my belief that gold and silver, mainly gold, but silver is going to also, I believe, going to have an exponential rise, is going to be the haven. It's going to be the ark.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's very difficult for people to understand this, having really no experience of it. And that's why, you know, what I've said is that your first responsibility is to understand the crisis. And once you understand it, then it's going to be clear what you should do to protect yourself. And in my book, I talk about, the title is How to Survive the Crisis and Prosper in the Process. And it was subtitled Time of the Vulture. And what it said was this, is that in times of expansion, it is to the hair the price goes. Quick, risk-taking, and bold, his is the best bet during those times. In times of contraction, the tortoise is favored. Slow and cautious and quick only to retract his vulnerable head and neck. His approach is the best during these times. But every once in a while, there comes a time when neither the tortoise nor the hare is triumphant. And this is the time when the pastures of the bull lie buried beneath economic collapse. And the bear's lair itself is destroyed. And what I say in the book is, I call this the time of the vulture. And the vulture feeds not upon the bear or the bull. The vulture feeds upon the denial and ignorance of the ostrich. So what I would suggest to the caller from Kauai is to look at what is going on and shift from being an ostrich into a vulture, because you're going to be one of the two. There's no middle ground. There's no middle ground. And if you have assets to liquidate, get rid of your debt, I mean, I can be very draconian, and I know about selling your house and what that feels like now, but I believe that we are going to... People don't understand what a depression is like. I mean, it happened so long ago, nobody knows.
Well, we have a huge population on this planet that weren't even born.
Well, they weren't even born then.
When that occurred.
That occurred. What
so
they don't know.
It's definitely an experience they've never had.
The stock market, in 1929, when it collapsed, it lost 90% of its value. 10 years later, it was down to 10% of what it once had been. So if you're going to talk about the stock market today at 13,500, let's say, all right, and take it down to 10%, which is 1,350 in the year 2017, that is what happened during the Great Depression.
Well, and I think we have a modern-day experience that we can definitely learn from when we look at the economic crisis that Japan has just gone through and is still bringing themselves out of. And one of the key things that Japan has instituted in their country is the complementary currencies that Bernard Leiter has been supporting throughout the world to create complementary currencies, of which Switzerland has had the LET system for years. Canada has the LET system. And in America, we have the Ithaca dollars in Ithaca, New York, and I think there's one other place that has in their community a complementary system for exchange.
Yeah. To go back to Bernard's book, this book, The Future of Money, is not, I don't think it's available in the United States. There's a book called The Future of Money with an entirely different point of view than his. In fact, I think it was written to offset Bernard's book. Bernard's book is published by Random House and is not available in the United States, but you can get it from Amazon UK.
Uh-huh.
And that just shows the collusion that's happening in this country. Here this guy is a world expert, taught at the University of California, Berkeley, written one of the absolutely extraordinary books on the planet, and Americans, maybe they can now, but the last time I looked, they couldn't. Not in your bookstores, all right?
Well, and I really want to recommend that book you, Daryl, because it's a brilliant piece of work, and this man is extraordinary in his view of the world currencies, as you are with your information. So it is a huge resource. One of the things when the friend called in from Maui, this is one of the things we can do is read these books, and Bernard Leiter's book is definitely one of them.
It's definitely one of them. For practical advice, that's my book. I talk about that a lot, you know, of what you can do. I have investment suggestions and who to see. There are people to see. I'm basically precious metal based, but it certainly bears a lot of study and a lot of thought. I would like to also suggest another book for people who both have assets and for those who don't. And you know, Kay, that in my book I put an addendum at the end where I talked about the law of attraction.
Right.
And I believe that these are going to be times, as Thomas Paine says, that test men's souls and women's souls and children's souls. All right? And we're going to go to the well. And if your well has assets in it, you better redeploy it. Redeploy them. And if your well doesn't have financial assets in it, you do have a well. And these are times that are going to force you to go there. I mean, in a deeper way than most people ever have. We, you know, it's only during times of crises that we reach those parts of ourselves that are there.
That's true.
It's just human nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we could have, we would remain as we were in 5 years old and still be on that little playground thing, not going home like our parents wanted us to. But we, on this stage of our journey, our human journey, much of what we learn comes through adversity. That's just the truth. And it's through trial and fire. And that's where our character is formed. That's where we find those parts of ourselves that, you know, we had no idea were there. And this, there's this book that was, you know, pop. It was in the movie The Secret. And of all the stuff I've read, and I've had an extensive background on this, the book Asking Is Given by Esther and Jeremy Hicks, I cannot recommend that more. Because my feeling is, if you have no assets, if you don't have the means to go down and put $10,000, $100,000 in a gold ETF, exchange-traded fund, or something like that these times, or silver, you can get Asking Is Given by Esther and Jeremy Hicks and read it and take it to heart. And as you said, Kate, we are in this together, and we are all in this together, even the ones who appear to be disconnected from us. And the ones who appear to be on the other side of this drama that we're working out. And in my higher state, I can see, I know that we all have a role to play in this.
Exactly.
I know it, even though I'm absolutely opposed at every level of my personal being to what they're doing. But I know everyone is doing what they're doing to play out this role as we're going through this transition. And I have, you know, in meeting you, I just want to say this to the listeners on this program. I met you, Kay, through the Positive Deviant Network, which is a really extraordinary group of people. In fact, the Positive Deviant Network was formed by Marshall Thurber in 2005, and of the 60 people who were there at that first meeting, three of them were interviewed in the movie The Secret. That was going to come out a year later. All right. I mean, that's not bad for a batting
right.
average of the quality
right.
of people there. And among those people, my wife and I met you. And I can say that I was astounded by your presence, Kay, and your depth and your background. And that... that what you're about on this planet is really what the change is about and really what the vision is about where we're going. And I believe that eventually we're going to look at the time that we're about to enter like adults look at their teenage years. A little bit of, oh, my God, and a lot of, I'm glad that's over.
Right.
And a tremendous amount of, you know, I wouldn't be who I am now if I hadn't gone through that.
Yes, yes, it's absolutely so true. And, Daryl, I thank you so much for your reference to our meeting, and what a joy it has been for me to connect with you. And I know we've only touched the tip of the iceberg tonight, but I want to make sure now that people know how to get your books. And also I want to ask you, do you do corporate and personal consulting work with money issues? And tell us also, you're going to Hungary, I believe it is?
Yeah, we're...
Both in on how to get your books, if you do corporate or personal consulting, and where you'll be in Europe.
Okay. The book that I wrote, that I presented, it was really basically a white paper, an analysis of the crises facing the U.S. and global economy. It was presented to the Positive Deviant Network in March. It's available at www.survivethecrisis.com. And we are putting up another website that is going to basically be a collection and focus on my writings and my thoughts as we go through this process. And if you sign up for the email alert on that, you will be notified of the new website, which should be up in within the month.
Great.
And
now, where did it get Light in a Dark Place?
Light in a Dark Place, you can go up and get that at Amazon.
At Amazon,
Amazon.com.
Okay.
It's a collection of writings that I have that you're very familiar with.
It's absolutely wonderful for anybody to... It's so many areas of life that you've touched on in that, Daryl. It's exquisite. Now, what about consulting? Do you do personal or corporate?
I am available.
Okay.
For corporate, for any, basically, you know, on other levels. But I don't deal with specific investment situations.
Okay.
In my book, I have a list of who I consider the most capable people to take all of us through this period. And the difference being on your risk level, the difference being on who you're most comfortable with. And so that's up to the readers to determine for themselves.
Right, because you really provide a good resource in that. I remember that. Now, if people are going to contact you for inspirational speaking or educational or informational work with this, how would they contact you? Through the website?
The best way is through the website.
Okay.
It's called info. It's an email, info@survivethecrisis.com.
Okay, great.
That'll get to us.
Great.
And then
now,
I'll be available.
I want to recap here what we've talked about. We referred to several books tonight, and I know that one of your favorites right on the top of the list is Ask, and It Is Given. That's by Esther and Jerry Hicks, H-I-C-K-S. Then we talked about Future of Money by Bernard Leiter, and that last name is spelled L-I-E, T as in Tom, I-E-R. And from your awareness, that book is available on Amazon.com in UK.
Yeah.
And then I would like to also refer a book recently introduced to me by a friend when I was on the cruise with Dr. Emoto. This book is called Busting Loose from the Money Game, Mind-Blowing Strategies for Changing the Rules of a Game You Can't Win. This book is by Robert Scheinfeld, S-C-H-E-I-N-F-E-L-D. Now, this book is an amazing book because he's using the icon of money, but he's teaching universal principles. So it's one of the pieces, this book and Ask and It Is Given and Future of Money, I think respond to our caller from Maui. These are some phenomenal tools to help us educate ourselves in today's world of economic and life-transforming conditions so we can be more reliable, more accountable, and more realistic about what does it mean to live on this planet as a global family. So I want to also ask now again, Daryl, you're going to Hungary, I believe you said.
Yeah.
And when do you go there?
We're leaving in 2 weeks. There's a conference in Hungary, and it's on gold specifically. But the conference is being led by a gentleman, Dr. Antal E. Feketa.
Uh-huh.
And he is probably the... It's hard to say. He's an expert on monetary matters and the role of gold. And it's something that he calls the Gold Standard University. And he's a retired professor emeritus. He's firmly rooted in all the classical economic books. And one of the most original thinkers on this planet in terms of money. And he's absolutely brilliant. I ran across his writings years ago and was stunned by his clarity and his intellectual rigor. And he's going to be giving this week-long course on gold and its role, and I'm going to be speaking at it, and it's going to be very, very interesting, I believe, and
now,
that'll happen in the next 2 weeks.
Maybe after you come back from that, you would consider coming back on our show again, Daryl, and fill us in on what you learned from that conference. Would you be willing to do that?
Sure. Sure. My metaphor about that conference, Kay, is sort of like... you know that bridge that just collapsed in
right,
in Minneapolis?
Mm-hmm.
The metaphor I have about it is that, you know, in 1990, that bridge was said to be unsafe.
Wow.
Okay? Now, and if that bridge was like the economy,
right,
there are people who felt in 1990 that it was basically built on a bad foundation, but everybody got used to it. All right?
Right.
And it got, in fact, most economists in that way, on that bridge, on the economic bridge, were concerned with doubling the lanes. All right, with crowd control, getting people more efficiently on and off that bridge, getting egress, and you know, like that's what most economists do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's increase the flow on that bridge. Let's go. Let's shore it up. You know, let's keep it on. Let's keep it going. We have to keep it going. Dr. Fekete is like a structural engineer, and he's looked at that bridge, and being a structural engineer, he has identified the weaknesses and the cracks and the way it's going to give, how it's inevitable that it's going to give way. And my metaphor about what this conference is in Hungary is I'm just joining the people who have become very interested in his works and his writings, and Martha and I are joining them to get together and discuss this situation collaboratively and under his direction. And it's sort of like we're looking at the bridge. Everybody's driving over. It's now 8 lanes. You know, it's got a commuter lane in the middle that switches.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and most everybody's just saying, "Wow, let's go." You know, let's get more people on the bridge. And we're looking at it, going, "You know, when do you think it's going to give way?" That's what we're going to be discussing.
Well, I want you to know, Daryl, that I certainly will be surrounding you and Martha with the Aloha spirit and blessings on your travel, safe journeys, and I know that you'll be an inspiration in sharing your information at this international gathering as well, and we'll look forward to our opportunity to hear more about that when you come back. And I just thank you again so much for your wisdom tonight and your willingness to be so available to share your expertise. Thank you so much, Daryl.
You're welcome, Kay, and anytime, I'm at your service.
Thank you, and I want to thank each of you as our listeners and let you know next week our topic will be stress and perception. How can we look at things differently and make a difference in our life? My special guest will be Shirley Orlick, who is a longtime friend and an incredible woman of a variety of wisdom and healing techniques. So I look forward to our time. I want to thank BBS Radio for extending our hour tonight so we could put in as much information as we possibly could. Now I'd like us all to just take a breath of gratitude here that we've been able to have this time together, that we've been able to talk, have freedom of speech, and once again bring in the Aloha spirit through our closing of Ano Ai Ko Ala Hele. Blessings on your journey. Ahui ho. Until we meet again. Aloha.